racial bias and perceptions of diversity, equity, and inclusion leaders. Take it away.
Awesome. Can everybody see my screen? Is it showing? Okay, great. All right, so I'm presenting my research today on the racial bias and perceptions of DEI leaders with my co-author, Vanessa Shum, who's a PhD student at Beattie School of Business. So many of you may have had the pleasure and privilege of seeing Ashley Shelby Rosette present in the JEDI seminar series. When she started her talk, I'm going to steal from her talk. She started her presentation off by saying, "Close your eyes. When you think of a leader, what image comes to mind?" And what she, you know, after some time, she said, "I'm sure what comes to mind is an image of a white male." This emanated or came from her research on the white standard, racial bias, and leader categorization. And in this stream of research, what she found is that being white is perceived as a core attribute of that traditional business leader prototype. She reasoned that this prototype evolves over several years, particularly because of exposure to various past and current leaders who are white. This could be a leader in the organizational sense, in politics, just kind of broad exposure to leaders who are white has formed this bias in our heads. This research was done in 2008, and so over the years she got some pushback and some people saying, well, maybe this has evolved over time. They ran another study in 2022 and found that this prototype still holds, particularly subconsciously. What's interesting, though, is that, you know, as our perceptions of race have evolved over the years, so have our perceptions of leadership. Particularly in the past few years, as you all know, the presence of a DEI leader within organizations has really begun to emerge. So we started to see, that head of diversity is the job of the moment. LinkedIn looked at a study and they found that over the past 5 years, roles like the head of diversity have really grown in prominence. Head of diversity, for example, had increased 107% between 2015 and 2020. What was interesting to me is that as this started to grow in prominence, we started to see speculation about who actually fills this role. Forbes and the New York Times ran some articles saying, you know, generally who we see in this role is a person of color. The New York Times actually went so far as to say that people who have no experience in DEI work were being asked to lead these types of initiatives in their organizations. So, you know, this really contrasted with what we know from research and from Rosette's studies. So it led me to this question of, do observers have a racial preference for DEI leaders? If so, why is this happening? So to kind of get into that academic speak of theories, I'll just briefly talk about this, but there's some core theories, social role theory and role congruity theory, which basically says that when we see overrepresentation of a particular social group in an occupational role, we tend to attribute the characteristics of that role to that social group. So the classic example is women and leadership. Women have traditionally been in more caretaking, nurturing roles like a teacher or nurse, or even in terms of the family roles, that the owner of that caretaking responsibility, that often contradicts from how we think of leaders as being agentic and proactive. And so that same idea of, is there congruity between how we traditionally or stereotypically view that group with how we view that role, that can really facilitate our acceptance of that type of person in that role. So for this present study, I wanted to look at, well, what are these stereotypical characteristics of non-white groups? And then what are the prototypical characteristics of a DEI leader? If there's congruity, we should see that people are more accepting of a non-white person in this particular leadership role. So drawing on some of Rosette's reasoning and theorizing, one of our thoughts was that we traditionally see non-white individuals in leadership roles. There was a study that found 73% of DEI officers and managers are non-white currently. Historically, you know, you think of Martin Luther King Jr., Gandhi, we think of non-white individuals leading social justice initiatives. So that first hypothesis really was looking at when we think about a DEI leader, do we have a preference, a racial preference for who that person should be? Continuing on with this theorizing, the idea was, well, if we see this basic relationship between DEI leader and a racial preference, what are those traits that facilitate this relationship? We have knowledge of traditional leader attributes, sensitivity, intelligence, dedication, masculinity, tyranny, and dynamism. But we also wanted to start looking at if there are role-specific traits that might also facilitate this relationship. So we looked at some new role-specific attributes, a commitment to social justice, and suffering discrimination. So the idea was to look at whether these traits were correlated both with that DEI leader role, as well as with those racial social groups. And then last but not least, why does this matter for practice? Why does this matter for organizations? The overall idea here is to understand, well, does race lead people to assume that that individual has certain traits, those leadership traits that we just discussed? If so, does that then lead to outcomes that matter for the workplace? Particularly, do we see that person as more of a leadership, more appropriate for that leadership role? And do they receive higher or stronger hiring recommendations? So I'm going to dive into these studies. There's a lot more going on with these studies than is what's in the presentation, but for the sake of time, I really want to highlight some of the findings that I found that we thought were the most interesting. So the first study was establishing that racial bias in DEI leader prototypes. We ran an experiment with two conditions. We presented the respondents with a press release of a new leader being appointed to either head of finance or head of DEI. So we switched the title of the role. We provided different descriptions of what that role does. And then we asked respondents, what do you think is the race of that leader? What do you think is the leader's gender? It was fascinating, really interesting, kind of just to get that basic information. When you look at the head of finance, we see that majority here, you know, in line with what Rosette found, perceived the leader to be white. Interesting, when the condition was that head of DEI, we did find a majority of people perceived the person to be non-white. In particular, we found this strong bias toward perceiving the person to be Black or African American. We also, you know, initially this was a somewhat exploratory, so we wanted to look at gender perceptions as well, and we didn't find that relationship with gender. There was that initial question of whether people would assume that DEI leader was also a woman. We did not see that, so we pursued the line of racial bias. Just to show you the statistical analyses, we did run regressions, but I think this visual presents the findings most clearly. You know, when we had the DEI leader condition, here we see the significant preference for a non-white candidate. For the traditional leader, that significant preference for a white, bias that the perception is the person is white. So we found support for hypothesis one. Moving into study two, we wanted to look at those traits. What are those traits that may facilitate this bias for non-white people in that DEI leader role? Okay. In this study, we ran six conditions. We looked at four races, white, Black, Hispanic, and Asian, as well as the two leader roles. We switched to operations this time to make it a little bit more generalized rather than that kind of stereotypical finance bias. So we asked in the following task, we will ask you questions about the stereotypical attributes of Asian people. For the role in particular, we listed the role, but we also provided descriptions for both the DEI leader as well as an operations leader. And then we also ask questions about the traits that are associated with either the racial group or the leader role. We first wanted to see if our hypothesis one from study one was replicated.
Sprinkle these everywhere too.
This was really astounding. The traditional leader role, when we changed it to
a
very generalized
leadership enough, role,
overwhelming dominance of that perception of that person, the leader, is white. And again, we see this repeated pattern where the DEI leader is
brown.
Assumed to be non-white. This was the really interesting thing and what we were trying to get at in terms of correlations with the leadership role as well as with the racial social group. In terms of the traits, we ran interclass correlation coefficient as well as Pearson's coefficient. This is fairly typical in studies examining social role theory. And we found this pattern, again, where the traits these leadership traits that were traditionally associated with that leader role were also those traits more strongly associated with the white social group. And then here you see, again, this really strong pattern, the traits that are associated with the DEI leader role are also stereotypically associated with non-white social groups. So we aggregated it to show that there's this overall pattern with non-white social groups, but also it's really interesting to see this a consistent pattern even within these individual non-white social groups. That leads us to study three. I think I'm doing somewhat okay on timing. I'll try to go through this fairly quickly. But when we get to study three, this is where we wanted to see the implications for research or for the practical world. And so we really wanted to look at leadership perceptions and hiring recommendations for that DEI leader role. We looked at four conditions this time: white, black, Hispanic, and Asian. And this is only hiring for the DEI leader role. We looked at this also at two time points. So at time point one, we gave an overview or a summary of a particular candidate who was up for a DEI leader role. We buried this candidate's profile. The only thing we changed was the name and the racial description. Everything else was the same. We also asked about those traits associated with that candidate, and then asked about hiring perceptions or leadership perception and hiring recommendations. Here you'll see within the regression analyses that we did, significant relationship where the candidate's race influenced leadership perceptions and hiring recommendations. So non-white candidates received higher leadership perceptions and stronger hiring recommendations. This was the interesting part of this study three, though. We really wanted to see which of those traits facilitated those more positive evaluations of the non-white candidate for that DEI leader role. The traits that facilitated this relationship were those new leader attributes: commitment to social justice and suffering discrimination. These were the significant mediators facilitating that path between candidate race and leadership perceptions and hiring recommendations. What we hope is this contribution of the research is that, in contrast to prior research, which has found that, you know, traditional leadership roles are assumed to be fulfilled by a white candidate, we're finding this specific leadership role that kind of bucks the trends that is associated with a non-white candidate. We're also showing the importance of looking at leadership role-specific traits. If we're just using these generalized leadership traits, we may be missing some of this nuance that can highlight underrepresented individuals and how they may be perceived as a better fit for that leader role. And then we're also contributing to race and role theories. You know, we have a lot of understanding about how gender is perceived, gender roles. Interestingly, we have very much less of an understanding of racial roles. What kinds of traits and stereotypes are associated with particular races? here we're showing that non-white races are associated with that commitment to social justice, as well as an assumption that they have suffered discrimination. So we're contributing in that way. I'm pleased to say that this this research was recently accepted at the Journal of Applied Psychology. It's currently in press, so when that does make it to the online edition, I'm happy to share that research as well. And I think I'm within the time frame, but I just wanted to close there and open it up to any questions. I also wanted to say thank you very much. This EDI Catalyst grant was instrumental in allowing us to run this research. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Rebecca. That was perfect because we had Dr. Rosette as one of our Jedi speakers this year, so this builds so nicely.
Yeah.
Did you want to moderate questions yourself, or did you want me to jump in?
I can do it. That's fine. John, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I had two questions. First, I wanted to ask if you also looked at these effects in terms of gender and not just race. And then the second question is, I'm wondering if for a follow-up study, are you considering whether the race and gender of the DE officer makes a difference in predicting like DEI outcomes that you would want to see from a DEI officer in terms of like how the people react to them and whether or not their DEI initiatives are more or less effective because of the demographics of the person who is leading the cause?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and one we got from reviewers as well, particularly that first question about how gender plays a role. What we found in that first study is that there wasn't a preference for non-males to be in that role. What was interesting, I didn't put it in here, but then we also asked that same question in study two, and we did see the flip where respondents did assume that the person was non-male. And so that was an interesting kind of lead to maybe next future steps, but in order to make sure that we were making the points that we wanted to make in terms of contributions to racial role theory, we stuck with race for study three in particular. And then, yeah, I think that your question about how that DEI leaders initiatives is a logical next step. That's what we see even within gender role theory papers, you know, we think should be in that role, how do people react to that leader in that role. So yeah, that's a really great step for future research. Dave?
Hey, great presentation, really interesting research, and yeah, congrats on the publication. And I have a question just about studies one and two. When you're seeing people have these different associations between the different positions and different races, and I was wondering if you got any base rate data just like on baseline levels, because in the beginning you were saying how I think you put up a stat that the DEIers do tend to be more, and so I was wondering if you have a sense of like how accurate or biased people are in their associations.
Yeah, so I'm sorry, you cut out partially. So the you were particularly highlighting the association between the DEI leader and Black social groups, is that?
I thought you put up a stat about that at the beginning, that those did tend to be more non-white. And so basically I was wondering if people, the association data you have in study one and study two, if, you know, where you see these differences in associations for the different positions, but is that are those accurate associations based on the real world base rates, or are people biased in one direction or another compared to the actual stats? And I was wondering if you've checked on that, and if so, I was curious.
Yeah, that's a really great question. There's only one study that I know of that did a sample of LinkedIn positions. They looked at LinkedIn positions in terms of DEI manager or DEI leader, I believe, and they did find, I believe it was 73% were non-white. In particular, this relationship between a Black individual and the DEI leader role we had to respond to reviewers about this, actually. The thought is that particularly over the past few years with the Black Lives Matter movement, society has kind of perceived the Black social group to take the lead in social justice movements. And so that might be where we see this preference. When you ask, you know, without, when you have to select a particular person, there's this preference. But what was interesting with those subsequent studies is that when you kind of open it up, we see that there's no preference, or that there's similar perceptions about that non-white, any non-white category for that DEI leader. But in terms of comparison to actual, what we see, generally it does seem to track.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Very interesting research, and congratulations for the publication. I'm wondering whether when people think or imagine a leader, everybody automatically thinks about a specific ethnicity or race. Another way to ask this question, like for instance here, what do you think is the race of the leader? If you had an option saying, well, I did not think of any specific ethnicity, do you think this option would have collected a lot of answers?
No, that's a really good question. I think, you know, at the heart of it, trying to get it to that prototypical, what do we think is the prototypical DEI leader? If we had said, you know, I didn't think about it, I kind of think there would be some social desirability bias there, to be honest. This is just kind of my opinion. I think people do tend to have, you know, even if it's subconscious, that there is a bias or a subconscious understanding of who that person should be. So, but that would be an interesting question to research.
That was perfectly timed because we are at time to switch to our next presenter. So again, thank you so much, Vicky, for presenting that fascinating research. Very interesting to see. Can't wait to see next steps. Our next presenter is Brad Wong, who is a PhD student, and the project is with Dr. Jonathan Evans, an assistant professor, and they're both coming to us from the Organizational Behavior and Human Resources Division and presenting their work on which workplace ally behaviors are beneficial, public versus private confrontation and affirmation responses to gender equality. So take it away, Brad.
Everyone, my slides okay?
Confront he, him in public. Validate her in private. Effective allyship behaviors of team leaders.
And today I'm going to present our work with Professor and amazing author John Evans. Confront him in public, validate her in private. Effective allyship behaviors of team leaders in addressing sexist remarks. So to start with, women at work, as we can see, they continue to face a lot of offensive and even misogynistic comments in the workplace. They may be questioned their ability to perform well, or whether they are deemed too emotional and not logical in a workplace, which limits their career and ability. The recent statistics shows that 30% of the women have reported that they have been taught they only got a job or being promoted because of their gender. And 33% have implied that they are emotional, especially it might depend on their time of the month. And even 50% of the women have been told that their gender may limit their ability and prohibit their career. As we can see, these kind of offensive sexist comments are prevalent in the workplace, which marginalize women at work. And it is important for us to know how to address this situation and support women to weather this kind of storm in terms of gender discrimination in the workplace. And these kind of sexist remarks in the workplace, it often happens in teams. And some negative outcomes have been seen that they can reduce sense of belonging and lead to their feelings of being isolated. And it can also disrupt their distinctiveness and leading to their feelings that their individual and unique contribution to the teams are not being valued. And here we focus on the role of allies, which is defined as members of advantage groups engaging in committed actions to improve the treatment procedures of a disadvantaged group. And we focus on how male leaders and support your employees when encountering this kind of sexist remark, no offensive comments in the workplace. And the role of male leaders are important given the view from inclusive literature, which is focused on the leader behavior that creates a sense of inclusion in work teams. And to further illustrate what inclusion means, we draw on the theory of optimal distinctiveness and illustrate why our research is important to advance our understanding of effective allyship in leaders. So, optimal distinctiveness theories proposed by Brewer in 1991 suggest that humans have two basic needs. One is belongingness, and one is uniqueness. Mm. And these important needs are important to lead to the feelings of inclusion. However, the existing research that focused on allyship behaviors have been focusing on how to confront the transgressors, and especially the male transgressors in this situation about making sexist remarks. And this can cue identity safety and make female employees to feel they belong to the group. However, this does not ensure that inclusion is being made because this does not address the other uniqueness, which might also lead to assimilation. And inclusion is focusing on being treated as an insider and also allowed and encouraged to retain their uniqueness within the workload. So we draw on Ron Oster and the show qualitative research. They propose that there are two important allyship responses that have been overlooked in the literature. And the other response we focus on is validating female employees' experience in sexist remarks. And by validating, we mean that they maintain a listening and respective and non-judgmental manner in listening and affirming their experience. And this can help address their need of uniqueness. So this leads to our main research question is how do male leaders effectively respond to sexist remarks happening in teams? And because fostering inclusion is particularly context-specific, it advances social context perspective by focusing on the public and private settings of these two important allyship behaviors, confrontation and validation. And in one supplementary findings, we asked 81 male leaders to respond to a scenario in terms of a male coworker making a sexist remark in teams and what would they react. And 84% mentioned that they would confront the transgressor, but most of them mentioned that they would do it in private. And also a few of them mentioned that they would do the validation and they would do it in private. However, only less than half of the male leaders would do the act of validation, even though employees experience in the situation. And here, we build our theory that we focus on the perspective of the individual harmed by sexist remarks, which is female employees evaluating whether male leaders, their allyship behavior, are effective and supportive. And our prediction is that confrontation have to be made in public because it can signal greater perceived informed action, which is defined as the degree to which the members perceive that as allies actively and meaningfully intervene with discriminatory events. And by doing confrontation in public, the signal perceived informed action and which send diversity supporting signals, and it can also signal greater safety and reduce isolation. But eventually this will lead to a high sense of belonging of female employees. And on the other hand, for validation response, we argue that this should be done in private because it can signal greater perceived concern for dignity, which we refer to the extent to which individuals perceive that the male leaders demonstrate a commitment to their inherent worth and value as individuals. And this is important to be done in private because it would not bring humiliation or the harm, and also strengthen their social image. And this further express concern about their feelings and interests. And eventually, we argue that this private validation will lead to a higher value of feelingness in the eyes of female employees and leading to their willingness to speak up in teams, which would visualize us from multiple ways, expressing ideas for improving existing work practice. And here we conduct three register studies to focus on the perspective of female employees. So each of them will read a workplace scenario of a sexist remark, and to generalize to different kind of sexist remark, we select one of three kind of sexist remark for them happening in team meetings. And we also assign different male leaders responsive in terms of whether they confront or validate or do both. And as mentioned, our vocal mediators of perceived form of action and perceived concern predictively and our outcomes of sense of belonging and promoted voice. And for the first study, we focus on confrontation and their settings. So we argue that colleague confrontation would be better than private confrontation. And we also recommend whether doing something, either in this public or private, is better than not confronting. And we use a direct quote from existing research that focuses. For example, that kind of comment had no place in our culture. In the second study, we focus on male leaders of the validation response. And we also investigate their settings in terms of public, private, or no validation is offered. And we want to be more careful because we don't want to position male leaders as being male saviors or shepherds. So we conduct a series of pilot testing and from the female employees' perspective, and eventually we chose this validation language that is most respectful and non-judgmental. For example, the male leader in addressing sexist remarks in teams, they will mention that was an inappropriate and absent remark, so I will ask how you are doing. Are you okay? Would you like a moment to discuss what happened or take a break? In the third study, we realized that these two behaviors would not It's not mutually exclusive and they can co-occur, so we focus on confrontation and validation and their tactics. So for study one results for confrontation, we find that there's a significant difference between public and private confrontation in perceived informed action, but not concern for dignity. And eventually, this public confrontation will lead to a sense of belonging through perceived informed action, but not lead to promotive voice. And as additional result, we also find that confrontation compared to not confronting is always effective. And for study two, we focus on validation. And we find that public validation and private validation did not matter in terms of informed action, whether they perceive the male leaders or intervene for the sexist remarks. But it did show that private validation leads to a higher perceived concern for dignity, that female employees feel that the leaders are really trying to take care of their experience during this hard time. And we find that private validation compared to public validation will eventually lead to higher promoted voice. And this is mediated by perceived concern for dignity. And an additional finding, which we did not theorize, is that this can also lead to a higher sense of belonging through perceived concern for dignity. And for additional results, we also find that validation compared to not validating is effective and can lead to beneficial outcomes for people. And finally, in the third study, we focus on the role of confrontation and validation and their settings in terms of public or private. And we find that for perceived informed action, public confrontation and private validation fare best and reaches the highest level for perceived informed action. But public validation and private confrontation leads to the worst outcome for perceived informed action. And for the other the perceived concern for dignity. We also find that public confrontation and private validating female employees' experience lead to the higher concern for dignity compared to others. And again, private confrontation and doing validation in public lead to a lower perceived concern for dignity. In terms of the downstream outcomes, we find that this eventually translates into a higher sense of belonging and higher promoted voice for public confrontation, cross private validation, and the worst outcome is based on private confrontation and public validation. So to summarize, we predict that public confrontation will lead to a sense of belonging through perceived action, and this result, our results support this prediction. And we also find that private validation is more effective compared to public validation and leading to promoted voice through perceived concern for dignity. And additionally, we also find that private validation lead to a higher sense of belonging through perceived concern for dignity. And for last study, we find the allyship combination that public confrontation and private validation, these two responses will be our best in terms of compared to other allyship combination responses. And the recommendation for, based on our research and also for all the men in this Zoomland, is that to confront in public, this includes statements of, I didn't find that to be funny, I didn't like the way they did this woman, that comments, there's no place here. And also validating in private, that was an appropriate and upsetting remark. I would like to ask, how are you doing? Are you okay? Would you like a moment to discuss what happened or take a break? So that's the end of the research. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Brad. That was a really interesting research, and I see we've already got some questions, so I'll leave it to you to moderate questions.
I can see the participants.
Okay, I'll take it for you. Sarah, please.
Thank you so much. I found this research really interesting and I took a lot of notes. I guess my question is about the inverse being true, because I guess maybe I present as a woman, and so I would much rather be criticized or confronted in private and sort of praised in public, but I'm not really sure if that tracks. You know, like I recognize that there's the perception and then there's sort of like the behavior, sort of the... Thank you. I hope that's a clear question.
Yeah, just to clarify, so you mean you would, from your perspective, you prefer the punishment to the male transgressor to be in private and reward in public?
No, to myself. Like, if I am the transgressor or whatever, if I'm the one who's made a mistake and, you know, like, said something rude or unbecoming, I guess maybe I'm sure that it would be, if I was a male, I would rather be reprimanded privately also. But my concern, I guess, is that it seems to be this like converse relationship, right? Because my presenting as woman means that I want my male boss to say, oh, good job on this, to the group, you know? And when I haven't done a good job, I want to be pulled aside and given a 1-2, this is what you should have done kind of thing. But I'm not clearly an academic, and so I just try to muddle through. Thanks.
And actually, Brad, if you don't mind, I have a response to this question.
Sure, you can.
So I think the comment you're making, Sarah, is really good, because one of the things we wanted to address is it's a common leadership aphorism that you criticize in private and praise in public. That's kind of what leaders are asked to do. And one of the things that we wanted to do with this project is to sort of, rather than focus on what are the needs of the transgressor, what are the preferences of the transgressor, so much as sort of pivot towards what about
victim.
The person who's harmed by the cop, what do they care, what do they want? And so, and I absolutely agree with your point about, like, what if you publicly humiliate in a way the person who's transgressing, are they going to then backlash afterwards, and how are they going to react? And I think the important follow-up study is, okay, then what do you do after this important public confrontation? What can you do after that to help reduce the likelihood of backlash and reduce the likelihood that they'll continue to make those kind of comments? Does that make sense?
Definitely. Thank you so much. I really see how it is specifically looking at a specific, you know, transgressors being the sort of like was brought up in the previous presentation about, like, who do we think is a leader? It's the classic, you know, male, white, old, rich kind of. And I'm sure that some of those leaders are really valuable, right? You know, but yeah, that's, I'll stop.
Wonderful. And we have a question from Brad.
I just want to say thank you very much for this research, and Sarah bringing up this point. What I really appreciated, Brad, about this was I've worked for a number of years a startup called Soji123, mm-hmm. and that's around sexual orientation and gender identity. Mm-hmm. And one of the most downloaded resources we had for the BC education system in Alberta was Why That's So Gay Is Not Okay. And so it's just like in that moment where you're, you know, think about walking through school in hallways and you're like, oh, you're so gay, or that's so gay. I'm a gay male. And that's the sort of thing where in the moment to have somebody like a teacher say, hey, that's not our culture here. Like, that's not what our school is about. And to confront the student who's doing that in a way that helps not shame, but build their capacity to understand why it's not an okay word. So I do think, kind of Sarah, when you brought that up for me, it was in the moment, behavioral conditioning, but doing it in a way that's not shaming, but also just basing it on like what your culture or what your values are, and ideally in a capacity building way for that person. And so it's nice to have some studies about that public-private allyship and how to approach that. Like, it was, like, for sure, for 3 years running, the most downloaded resource for educators in the BC education system. So thank you, Brad.
From Brad to Brad, love that.
It's nice to have the research on it versus just the experience.
Well, we are out of time for questions on this one, so we'll move on. Thank you so much to Brad and Jonathan for sharing their research. Dr. Jane, who's a PhD, and hopefully you can also hear me if I'm getting internet unstable. You still hear me?
Yep. Your sound is cutting out a little bit.
Okay.
Yes. I can hear you. Hi, can everyone hear me?
If I cut out completely, let me know. Yes, yeah. So Sid is soon to be assistant professor at McGill, presenting his research with Dr. Jan Cornell, who is an associate professor, and both are coming to us. Minority-owned labels and whether they help for minority businesses. So take it with it.
Yes, that sounds interesting.
Okay, can everyone, you see my screen?
Right now we see presenter view.
Presenter view, let's just... Oh, just give me 1 second. Let me just get this. There we go. All right. Okay, do you see my screen now and the full screen?
That's great. That's great.
Awesome. Great. All right. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining me today. Really excited to be talking about this project that I've been working with, along with my co-authors, Jan Cornell, Richard Habib, and Carl Kino, on minority-owned labels. So in this research, we investigate the research question, do minority-owned labels help or hurt minority-owned businesses?
Interesting.
And just to start off, the definition of minority-owned businesses. So minority-owned businesses are businesses that are at least 51% owned and controlled by minority individuals. And minority individuals are people who self-identify as being Asian Indian, Asian Pacific, Black, Hispanic, or Native American. This is the American definition. In Canada, we have similar definition, except that we recognize more subgroups that identify as being minority, as minorities, and we also use the term indigenous rather than Native American. So minority-owned businesses play a pivotal role both in the U.S. and Canadian economies. About 50% of all new businesses start in the U.S. tend to be minority-owned, generating about 8.7 million jobs and about $1.3 trillion of sales every year.
Despite the pivotal role that minority-owned businesses play in these economies, there have been some reports that suggest that minority-owned businesses suffer from poorer business outcomes compared to businesses that are not minority-owned. And as a result, there are companies out there that are now starting to use minority-owned labels as a tactic to increase consumer support for these businesses, with the intention that if people are aware that a business is minority-owned, they're more likely to support that business. So for instance, Google launched a feature on their platform where minority business owners could self-identify as being minority-owned. And Giant highlights their minority vendors through minority-owned labels such as Black-owned and Hispanic-owned. So despite the prevalent use of these minority-owned labels, it's unclear what the marketing implications really are. And that's why in this research, we answer two fundamental questions. We would first like to understand how minority-owned labels impact purchase intentions across consumer segments. And we look at two important segmentation variables. We look at participant ethnicity and political orientation. Mm. And we'd like to understand the psychological mechanism that drives response to these labels.
Ethnicity and political orientation.
But to understand how people react to these labels, we need to first understand what minority-owned labels actually signify. So minority-owned labels do highlight minority owners' race with the idea that the business wants to create passionate preferences based on the ethnicity of the business owner. So one can argue that minority-owned labels are an implicit endorsement of race-conscious decision-making. The idea that race should be taken into account when judging people, or in this case, a business. The assumptions that underlie race-conscious decision-making are that any inequalities that minority-owned businesses face compared to businesses that are not minority-owned are a product of systemic institutional discrimination. And through consumer action, we can remedy this inequality. In contrast, the racial colorblindness belief is a system of ideas that rejects race-conscious decision-making. And it's the idea that race should not be taken into account when judging people, or in this case, business. And of course, the assumptions that underlie racial colorblindness are different from race-conscious decision-making. The idea here is that any inequalities that minority-owned businesses face are not product of something systemic, but something else. Usually something meritocratic, something to do with effort or hard work. So the question here is, who are the people who endorse race-conscious decision-making, and who are the people who endorse racial colorblindness? And what we propose in this research are that the two important variables that predict these kind of beliefs. It's political orientation and ethnicity. And specifically, we're looking at consumer political orientation and consumer ethnicity. And past research has shown that there are differences in the endorsement of racial colorblindness across racial groups. So generally speaking, people of color, regardless of political ideology, do tend to engage in race-conscious decision-making, and they support racial categorization. White liberals tend to support the underlying assumptions of race-conscious decision-making as well. In contrast, white conservatives tend to support racial colorblindness, again, the belief that race should not be taken into account when judging people or businesses, and they tend to generally oppose racial categorization. So in this research, we propose the following theoretical model. We propose that political orientation and ethnicity will interact to influence response to minority-owned labels, and that this effect will be mediated by the endorsement of racial colorblindness. So more formally put, among white consumers, but not among people of color, political orientation predicts response to minority-owned labels. And among white consumers, the effect of political orientation on response to minority-owned labels is mediated by endorsement of racial colorblindness. Okay, and we ran a bunch of studies to examine these hypotheses. So in the first five studies, we basically examined how consumers respond to these minority-owned labels, and we had five studies with very similar design. We had two between subject conditions across these five studies. So we had a control condition and a minority-owned label condition. And we measured purchase intentions, political orientation, and ethnicity, or participant ethnicity. We used different samples across our five studies, and we had three important variations across our studies. So across these five studies, we used different owner ethnicities. In some studies, we used, for instance, a Black owner. In other studies, we used a Latinx owner. We used different types of minority-owned labels. And we also use different types of we also had different designs of the minority labels. So in some studies, the minority label was embedded in the logo itself, whereas in other studies, it was present in the text. And I'll show you some examples on the next slide. So this is a stimuli that we used in one of our studies. And as you can see, the stimulus on the left depicts what was presented to participants as a control label condition, and the stimulus on the right was the minority on label condition. And across all conditions, so all participants saw an article reportedly by Yelp that promoted Mill Street Cafe. And the only difference between the minority-owned label condition and the control label condition was that in the minority-owned label condition, Mill Street Cafe was advertised as being minority-owned. So in this case, it was advertised as being black-owned, whereas it was not in the control label condition. Please note that owner ethnicity was constant across conditions. Of course, the people were aware of the owner ethnicities across these conditions, but this is so that we don't have ethnicity as a confound in our studies. Okay, so what did we find? So I will walk you through these graphs. There's a lot on the screen, but I'll walk you through them. These graphs depict the interaction of political orientation and label on purchased attentions among white participants, you can see on the graph on the left, and among people of color, as you can see on the graph on the right. So among white participants, what we found was that among whites with a political score below 2.5, so among white liberals, the minority label increased purchase intentions relative to control. In contrast, among whites with a political score above 4.8, so among white conservatives, the minority-owned label decreased purchase intentions relative to control. And the minority label did not increase or decrease purchase intentions relative to control for people of color, regardless of their political ideology. And we did run a meta-analysis where we examined the effect size of the label on purchase intentions among white liberals and white conservatives, and we found a very strong, robust negative effect of the label on purchase among white conservatives, and an inconsistent small positive effect of the label on purchase among white liberals. So generally speaking, we find a very robust negative effect of the label on purchase among white conservatives. So why is it that white conservatives react negatively towards minority-owned labels? And that's what we set out to do in study two. We recruited both white and black participants. So we recruited 100 white liberals, 100 white conservatives, 100 black liberals, and 100 black conservatives. And all participants were exposed to the following stimulus. So they read an article reportedly by Yelp promoting Mill Street Cafe, and Mill Street Cafe was advertised as being black-owned. Please note that we did not manipulate the label in this study, so all participants saw a business that was labeled as being black-owned, and then we measured purchase intentions. And we also had an open-ended question where we want to examine our mechanisms. So we asked people what they thought about the article that they just read. And the idea behind this is that we want to use kind of an inductive qualitative approach to understanding the mechanism. So instead of using a traditional strict conceptualization of racial colorblindness, we wanted the construct of colorblindness to emerge naturally in the participants' responses. So in this way, we have a richer understanding of how participants conceptualize racial colorblindness. Okay, so we use thematic coding to code all the open-ended responses. And this table depicts all the themes that kind of emerged in participants' open-ended responses. So the themes that are marked in green are associated with positive responses to minority labels, and the themes marked in red are associated with negative responses associated with minority-owned labels. And racial colorblindness did indeed emerge in our participants' responses. In fact, almost 50% of white conservatives rejected the minority-owned label based on a colorblind argument, compared to only 4% of white liberals, 0% of black liberals, and only 10% of black conservatives. So what's interesting here is that if you compare, there's a much higher endorsement of racial colorblindness among white conservatives compared to even black conservatives. And in fact, we did run a mediation analysis where we looked at political orientation as the dependent variable and response to minority labeled as purchase attention as a dependent variable, and we found that colorblindness did mediate the effect among white participants, but not among black participants. So indeed, colorblindness did play a role among white conservatives, and that's why they rejected minority-owned labels. So the takeaway are that white consumers compared to people of color are sensitive to the use of the label, and the valence depends on political ideology, and white conservatives compared to white liberals and people of color are less likely to purchase from a business using a minority-owned label, and this effect occurs because white conservatives endorse racial colorblind beliefs. Great, thank you.
Perfect
timing and amazing research. Thanks for sharing, Sid. And folks, feel free to put questions in the chat or raise hands.
Oh, I can't see the chat for some reason.
There's something.
I can read out if anything comes into the chat. I'll read it for you.
Thanks.
And there's a hand from Jonathan.
Hey, yes. So just a real quick question. I'm curious. How did you measure political orientation?
So political orientation, we used two items, we asked people whether they identified as being liberal or conservatives, and whether they were left wing or right wing. And and it was a continuous scale from 1 to 7.
Got it. Okay, good. Follow up question. Did you see a lot of folks on the edges, or more in the middle, or like, well, how did it look in terms of the distribution?
So we did find, generally speaking, among people of color, more of a liberal skew compared to white individuals. But we, in studies too, and in the rest of our studies, we did specifically recruit those who very strongly identified as liberals and very strongly identified as conservatives. In those cases, we actually had some a bimodal distribution where we had among whites, we had people who strongly identified liberal and conservative, the same with people of color as well. This is in our subsequent studies, after studies 1A to 1B.
I see Daniel's hand.
Hello, great presentation. Sid, you know, I've always, when I think about these studies, I've always wondered if it would be fun to do a geographic comparison, because we know that we can categorize some states in the U.S. as highly liberal and other states highly conservative. And would that be a fun thing to do, to see if you could just bifurcate the regions and get the same results? Have you thought about that?
That's a great point. I think there is, we would like to do some kind of field study where we could use maybe the region as a proxy, or like a postal code as a proxy, understanding how consumers respond to minority labels. The challenge is that we have two variables. So we have political ideology and ethnicity. So we would need to identify, for example, certain neighborhoods. We have to identify who kind of identifies, for example, we have to identify minority individuals and white individuals, and then we have to also examine their political ideology. So it gets a little bit complicated with that, but something we can definitely look at and maybe brainstorm, try to see if we can kind of identify both those variables in a field study. That would be wonderful. Thanks.
And I see a hand from Kevin.
Hi, my apologies. My camera is not working, so I'm going to have to be incognito mode for just a second here. But thank you so much for the super wonderful, interesting presentation here. I had a question about the inductive qualitative methods that you're using. It was really cool to see you're using those inductive qualitative methods. I was kind of curious, though, about whether the claims that you were making based on those inductive qualitative methods were actually claims that you could make within the sort of purview of those methods, right? In the sense that you were saying white conservatives were essentially rejected minority labels because of X, Y, and Z.
Racism?
But what you were getting with the qualitative methods essentially was more about not necessarily, I mean, potentially why, right, or because of the sort of because situation, but there was more of this situation of like, they were telling you this, right? There's sort of a distinction, right, between the meaning that they're attributing to the situation as opposed to maybe why they actually do this, right? I was wondering if you maybe could comment on that, or if maybe we could have a quick maybe discussion about that, what the maybe the potential limitations of the method or what the method allows for in terms of the claims.
Yeah, great question and great point. I think, so we used, just to be clear about kind of the method we used, it was thematic coding, and research assistants were not given any themes beforehand, so they saw the responses and then decoded based on well, what they thought, kind of what the themes that emerged across the participants' responses. And yeah, there are some limitations.
Responses, right? This notion that, again, they're attributing meaning in a certain way, they're justifying their behaviors in particular ways, right? And that just process is super, super interesting in and of itself. It may not be able to say exactly why they're doing what they're doing, but there's something really important about how they're justifying what they're doing, right? So this is just, I'm not saying that the methods are limited from the perspective of it can't make these claims, but rather in the sense that it can't make the claims that you're saying that it can make, but there's such other stuff that's really, really cool about the method, right? And I'm wondering if there's a way to engage with that in the strengths of the method.
Yeah, I completely agree. And in fact, we do find there's some other, what I would like to kind of do a deep dive into some of the responses, is also look at kind of what people are, kind of what kind of racial colorblindness are they kind of endorsing? Are there, is it more like egalitarian forms? Because we know that the construct is pretty complex. Is the colorblindness based on kind of egalitarian forms, or like is it based on ignorance? Is it based on, so kind of the meaning behind, like, what is the construct before colorblindness that leads to kind of people believing that, right? What are the assumptions that people have that lead to kind of their endorsement of colorblindness? So I think that if we do a deep dive into those responses, I think that would be pretty fruitful, and we would get a deeper understanding into how people are even conceptualizing colorblindness in their minds.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
Everyone is so on time today. We are just out of time for questions for Sid, so that is fantastic. Thanks for sharing and thanks for all the discussion. So we'll be turning to our last presenter, which is Dr. Michael Daniels, who is an assistant professor of a PhD student before he became an assistant professor at Ivy. They're presenting their work on effects of shame and pride on disclosure of stigmatized...
Shame and pride. Good one.
Hello, I'm not sure if that's your internet.
Yeah, it's hers.
Maybe it's mine. Hopefully people can hear me.
No, yours is fine.
I've been also having some issues with mine today. Let me just share my screen here. All right, so thank you everybody for being here today. Such a nice crowd on a Friday. For all this really great work that we've seen so far. My name is Michael Daniels. I'm presenting this on behalf of our team, who was led by Barnidhi Bhattacharya. She was meant to present this today, but turns out she had somewhere to be today. So I will do my best to power through. I presume this is the Ivy Business School building in the background here, which is where Barnidhi is now. I think maybe you said that, Kirsten, but it was cutting out for me. Okay, so the title of the project that we're working on is The Role of Shame and Pride in the Management of Concealable Stigmatized Identities at Work. And in particular, we sort of proposed this idea and got some grant funding for it. We weren't exactly sure which stigmatized identities we were interested in. In fact, we hope this generalizes to a number of them. But ultimately, we landed on what I think is an interesting and perhaps understudied stigmatized identity, which is that of someone who's a recovering alcoholic or somebody who suffers from an alcohol use disorder, which we would get into the distinctions of those later. Okay. So as I think we're all aware, most of us or all of us preside in
drinking cultures at work.
Part of Western and in fact also many Eastern cultures in organizations involve drinking, particularly at social events, of which the social events. And it turns out that the overwhelming majority of sort of professional networking social events in the West involve alcohol. So some estimates put it at 70%. And a large majority of employees feel at least that there's an expectation to drink at those events. And this is exacerbated when supervisors, people of power in the organization, people of status, engage in drinking. It signals to others that this is what we do at these sort of events. And so the question you might ask is, well, what does this mean for employees who do not drink? And they may not drink for many reasons, right? Religious reasons or just a personal choice. But it also may be the reason that somebody is a recovering alcoholic and attempting to stay sober. And so they may decide not to attend these sort of functions in the first place, or they may attend and not drink, and this often creates tension for them. People may ask questions, people may ask, hey, do you want to go get a drink with me? And they have to figure out how to navigate that. Do they disclose? Do they tell somebody why they're not having a drink? Do they make up a reason? Or what do they do? And this is not a small problem, or it doesn't affect a small percentage of employees. We're talking about here about alcohol use disorders, which is a broad condition. The DSM-5, the most recent manual that is used to assess this sort of disorder and other mental health conditions, suggests that it's a condition characterized by an impaired ability to stop or control alcohol use, despite its many adverse consequences for the person. And so this is a broad disorder. So it ranges from quite mild to quite extreme, which is maybe what we would call more colloquially alcoholism. And so using this broad definition, we know that almost 29 million adults in the U.S. anyway suffer from some version of AUD, which is over 11% of the adult population. And one in five Canadians aged 15 and older also suffer from AUD. And among those who are diagnosed with an AUD, 36 to 60% of them are currently sober, which is good news for them. So again, those are broad statistics. What we're primarily interested in is the more extreme end of the AUD, those who have had considerable difficulties in their lives. Many of them have sought treatment, medical or otherwise, for the condition. And it turns out that alcoholism and addiction are extremely stigmatized attributes.
Turns
there's
out.
A number of studies showing that people view those who have suffered from any sort of addiction, including alcohol addiction, as less than. And so they are alcoholism and other addictions are seen as not seen as a mental health issue. They're more likely to be seen as controllable. People who suffer from these conditions are more likely to be blamed for that condition, mm-hmm. unlike other types of mental health disorders, at least relative to those. And they're perceived as having a lack of willpower, and this puts a moral condemnation stamp on them. And even after someone overcomes and recovers from alcohol addiction, the stigma of that addiction still persists. And so we call this residual stigma, and this creates shame, which we know from research by those here at UBC and elsewhere, that shame results in greater relapse. So shame is not something that helps someone stop doing what they've done in the past. It actually often leads to more relapse. So we're really interested in these sort of cycles of shame and identity management that likely result from that. So just to define shame, it's a feeling of inferiority, seeing oneself as fundamentally flawed or defective in some way. This quote, I think, is from some qualitative research that I think exemplifies this really well. So I didn't tell a lot of people to start with. I really didn't tell people I was so ashamed. I was so ashamed to admit to anybody that I was a recovering alcoholic. And so this fits with many of our intuitions, that somebody who feels a lot of shame about this identity is probably unlikely to want to share it with other people. And of course, that's the case, where shame does motivate withdrawal behaviors and a desire to sort of hide the self from you. So shame is associated with this sort of feeling of exposure to others that people they want to move away from the view of other people. And so we know that shame leads to this desire to hide, there's also research on secrecy and cognitive dissonance, which suggests that hiding information about the self actually can lead to more shame. So it sort of reverses the causal arrow there. And the reason for that, there's lots of theory there, but you can just think about the fact that when I decide to withhold something, it signals to myself that it must be something shameful, right? Otherwise, why am I hiding this piece of myself to somebody else? And so the idea here is that this could lead to these sort of vicious cycles of shame, further concealment of the identity, further shame, and the cycle continues. So the research questions here that we're interested in are trying to get at this cycle and maybe some ways that we can reverse this cycle. I really like this quote from this old movie from the 50s. It was a novel that became a movie, The Incredible Shrinking Man. I don't know if anyone's seen it. I'm guessing probably not. It's an odd film, very good though. And the quote that I quite like from it is, "I was telling the world about my life, and with the telling, it became easier." And so I think this gets at something that's potentially true, that sharing that stigmatized part of the self is freeing, it's liberating. It's a way to signal to oneself and others that this is nothing to be ashamed of, particularly with this identity, because it's something that has both positive and negative components, right? You can feel shame over the history of addiction. You can similarly feel pride, perhaps, over your recovery from it, your ability to overcome that affliction.
It's twofold.
So I think this is a particularly interesting identity to look at with regard to shame and pride. So the first question is, can disclosing a history of alcohol addiction in a psychologically safe way reduce shame, particularly about the addiction, and enhance pride about the recovery? We were also interested in the degree of control that one has over crafting their narrative. We did a number of qualitative interviews, actually, sort of as we were preparing for this study, and we were interviewing people with different stigmatized identities. And one thing we heard from a lot of people is being outed was something that was really traumatizing for them. So we spoke to some people from the LGBTQ community who said that being in an environment that felt unsafe, if somebody were to sort of ask them directly in a public way or suggest to others in a public way that they had this sort of identity, they found it to be really distressing. So we're interested in whether having a degree of control over crafting a narrative around their identity actually matters here. And then subsequently, we're interested in whether this disclosure affects future behaviors. So as you're going to see, that we use an experimental paradigm here where we ask them to disclose, but we're interested in, does this create a cycle that results in further disclosure down the line? So here's the theoretical model. So again, a disclosure, and disclosure by that we mean sort of an act, an event of disclosing, should affect shame and pride in the moment differentially, which then should impact subsequent behaviors. I should note though that we haven't measured behaviors yet in this first study, so they're behavioral intentions at this point. And then the first path there, moderated by the degree of control one has over the narrative. So for example, if someone is able to say, "I was a recovering alcoholic, I went through a period of my life that was quite difficult, and I had a poor upbringing, and through many years of hard work and dedication, I was able to overcome that, and I'm now in recovery," that's a degree of control over crafting their own narrative that we think is important here. On the flip side, if somebody asks the person, "Why aren't you drinking? You have a history of drinking problems or something," and there's no time to sort of sit down and have a fulsome discussion, that can be a way of sort of labeling. So if someone just has to say, "Yes, I'm a recovering alcoholic," and that's all they get to say, they may feel a lack of narrative control there. And so we think that might be an important moderator of these effects. So the sample that we collected, and are actually currently still collecting, are people who have experienced alcohol addiction but are currently sober and in recovery. We've been recruiting from local treatment facilities here in Vancouver, and have been attempting to do some as well in Ontario to various degrees of success. So if anybody knows anybody or that would be willing to participate in our study, please have them reach out to me. So we do have some participants in our sample from these facilities, and we've augmented that data set with Prolific, an online panel data collection service. They actually do have
cut out. Oh no. Bums. I hate it when this happens. This is really valuable and interesting for me. It's the Dillon, D-H-I-L-L-I-O-N-E-D-I Catalyst Research Showcase.
Did we lose Mike or did we lose me?
No, I think we've lost Michael.
Oh, no. Mike.
Okay, we'll give him a second to come back online. We'll just hang tight for a second.
Hanging tough.
That was really interesting.
Tough enough.
Yeah, he knows how to leave on a cliffhanger. Yeah. Mike, are you back? I'm seeing. Yeah, dropped off again.
Big back has a big front. Big front has a big back. It's really amazing the technology enabling this kind of sharing of minds and learning across these this is UBC work, I think, but also studying other places and the ability to participated in it from the West Coast, British Columbia.
I'm in Texas in case he doesn't rural realize.
Rural areas.
Oh, he's back.
Oh, good.
Sorry about
We've
that.
All been talking about you.
Yeah, as it is.
Good. You left us on a cliffhanger. We're excited for the conclusion.
Imagine we're just sitting there in silence. Let me share my screen. Sorry, this is my internet is, I've just changed internet providers and it's still giving me sections.
Yay! Hopefully it's better than it was.
Okay, can everybody see that? So I don't know exactly where I was cut off, but essentially we're collecting a sample. We have currently 157 people. You can see the demographics there. Importantly though, 70% suggested they were formally diagnosed with an AUD, and over 78% have sought professional treatment for it. And the average length of their current period of sobriety is over 7 years. So we use an experimental design here. It's a 2x2 design. The first factor here is disclosure versus non-disclosure. And so really what we did was, the sort of cover story here was, we were interested in people who were recovering from alcohol addiction and how they form relationships post-recovery. So what are the sort of ways that they might interact with other people? And we said one way that's interesting to look at this is through the sort of letters people might write to each other. And so we said we're interested in having them write an autobiography. And in the first condition, we asked them to disclose in that autobiography something related to their alcohol, their history with alcohol addiction and recovery. And in the other condition, we very explicitly said, we want you to write an autobiography, but we want you to explicitly hide any prior history with alcohol addiction in that. And so sort of a disclosing versus hiding, as you might be able to think of it that way. And to make this feel a little bit less weird and not just ask them to randomly write a letter to nobody, we presented them with a letter that we said was from another participant in our study. So they read that letter, giving them a bit of an example of what they might write and the format that they might write it in, and then also give them a person to sort of latch onto that they can imagine in their mind who to whom they're writing. So that's the disclosure versus non-disclosure. And then, so you can see that actually at the bottom here, these two red boxes, those are the instructions. And then we also had two different forms of autobiography, as we called it. So one that we called interpretive autobiography, where the person had lots of leeway. It was a wide open text box. And we said, you can craft this narrative however you want. Just give the reader a lot of context about your life and how things fit together. And the other condition, it was more of like a form. So they just sort of had these headers. Oops, sorry. They had these headers and they just were meant to sort of fill them in. So they could write a bit. But it was structured in this way. And the big difference here is, this isn't the full letter, by the way. In between, the person had an opportunity to sort of flesh things out and make connections and explain prior periods of their lives. Whereas here, they didn't have a chance to connect and explain and contextualize. And so those were the two sets of conditions there. I think I'm probably going over time, so I'm gonna just sort of skip over this, but we used validated measures of shame and pride, as well as two identity management behaviors subsequent that they would engage in. So hiding behavior, which is exactly how it sounds, and embracing behavior, which is a much more open and transparent behavior. And then we created some manipulation checks there that I can come back to if anybody's interested. So the results for shame, we we actually found an effect here that was not exactly what we expected. So first of all, there's no main effect for disclosure. So for disclosure. So overall, people who disclose versus those who didn't disclose, there were no significant differences in their subsequent feelings of shame. However, there was a significant effect for the narrative condition. So those who were the narrative versus the non-narrative sort of form condition were less likely to experience shame on average. And the interaction was not quite significant. But again, as I said, I think we're a little underpowered still. So take that with a grain of salt. But the interaction is we might say almost as significant. And so the effect here is that it's really this one condition that pops out here, which is the group that was asked to disclose the identity, but had little narrative control over doing so. And so rather than there being this sort of positive effect for people who disclose in a certain way, it really just showed that people who were asked to disclose but weren't given an opportunity to contextualize it, they had worse outcomes than everybody else, as you can see in this one sort of condition here. The effects for pride were in the sort of similar direction, but not significant. Okay, so we then looked at sort of indirect effects here, just looking at the sort of aspect of the model that was significant so far. And what we found was that there was a significant indirect effect only for those who are low on the narrative control condition. So without having that ability to control, disclosure lets you more intentions to hide that behavior later on through the experience of shame. So just to wrap up here, what we found overall is that contrary to expectations, disclosing alcoholism history did not reduce shame or enhance pride on its own. However, disclosure can exacerbate shame, actually, resulting in future intentions to hide when it's done with little control to craft the narrative. So this has implications for those who want to be allies to recovering alcoholics, or people you might suspect to be recovering alcoholics. Employees need to feel a sense of control over the process of disclosure to avoid this sort of aspect of self-labeling and subsequent shame. And so although our study so far is not contextualized necessarily in the workplace, subsequent studies will do that. I think the preliminary evidence here so far is that asking somebody point blank, why they're not having a drink at a social probably doesn't give enough context for that person to contextualize their narrative. That's probably not a good idea, just as much as asking somebody on a form to just list maybe their prior addictions or mental afflictions. I can imagine the implications of that would be to increase shame over that if you don't give someone a chance to narrate it. I will note that in our study, though, because it's an online experiment and we manipulate conditions, everybody had relatively little control overall. They were required to disclose, they were required to hide. And so I think that might be compressing our effects here a little bit. So our follow-up research, we plan to do an experience sampling study where we actually capture these behaviors in the moment, these emotions in the moment. And that way we can actually capture volitional disclosure. So not just whether they disclosed in a certain way, but whether they chose to disclose at all, or whether maybe somebody else sort of solicited or asked a question. And we can see if that has an effect. Okay, thank you so much, and I can take some questions now.
Wonderful, thanks for sharing. And I see we've already got a hand. I can just get my screen so I can see who it is. Daniel.
Hey, Michael, great presentation, very interesting. I think you had most the audience on the edge of their seat. You certainly had me. Just a personal anecdote, one of my very good colleagues just came out of AA treatment, and I asked him, what was he learning out of the, what did he learn? And he said, very simple, three words, talk about it. And I said, why was that important? He said, because when I talk about it, it helps me control the narrative and my feelings of shame go away. I mean, this is strictly his words. But of course, as I'm listening to your report, I'm thinking there's got to be a pretty important moderator in regards to the closeness of the recipient who you're talking to. And I can imagine that going the opposite direction when you're a stranger or somebody who I work with and the embarrassment goes up. Any thoughts around that?
So we've sort of taken the social element out of this, but that's a huge factor, right? So there's a lot of research showing closeness matters, yes. The reaction of the listener or recipient matters. So if you disclose something and they react in a positive way, your emotions are very different than if they react in a callous or a negative way. I think you're totally right. This is what we have a better chance of getting at in an experience sampling study. So here it was obviously it was meant to be a real person, but not someone they knew or were close to. We thought that might be a safe environment, actually, right? So, I mean, you can make the case that disclosing to somebody who you're really close with is actually more sensitive. You might be more, acutely aware of micro facial expressions and things. So I would imagine the effect of closeness would moderate that for sure, either positively or negatively, depending, again, maybe the reaction. So yeah, it's something we didn't get at here, but I think you're right. That's an important piece of the full puzzle here.
And I might just think that psychological safety might be the mechanism that might help explain that as well. Thank you, Michael. Great talk.
Yeah, thanks for watching.
We have time for one more question, and since Dave already asked a question, I'll let Jen go, and then if we have time, we'll squeeze Dave back in.
Sorry, Dave. So really interesting. I had a quick question. So to look at the other side of the coin, have you looked at how these people who do disclose are perceived by their peers? Is that important at all in your research?
So it's important. It's probably outside the scope of this project. We are interested in the disclosure and their affective reactions and behaviors, but certainly, I don't know actually the answer to your question. I imagine there's some research on that. The stigma disclosure stuff. I wish Bernini were here. She'd probably have a great answer for you. I don't know. My hunch is that's also there would be an effect there, and there's probably lots of moderators of it. That's my. That would be my hunch, but as I mentioned at the beginning, these identities are stigmatized. So if the comparison is I'm unaware of the identity and now I'm aware of the identity, I can imagine that the main effect, the overall reaction, it would probably be negative. Now there might be a difference if you know someone's has a stigmatized identity like alcoholism, and they do or don't disclose, that might be a little different, right? So you maybe prefer right. the person who you know to have it, to be open about it. So it kind of maybe depends on kind of the comparison there. But yeah, it's a great question.
It depends how long they're recovered also.
Marnini would have a great answer for you. So if you want
to... Yeah, I just thought that if you were thinking about an intervention about how disclosure actually helps these people disclose more, because this is a two-way process, right? So it's not only the perceiver but also the people who perceive them. So I just thought if you look at the other side of that spectrum, that'd be also interesting.
And even the reaction even if other people are very positive about your disclosure, if you think they're not, right, or you're worried that they're not, that's what matters to that person. Right, and so I think you're right, that's a piece of the puzzle here. And so we're focused intrapersonally right now, but I think that's something we'll have to build out in the next study.
Pretty interesting.
Wonderful. And we are out of time. Luckily, Dave knows Mike, so they can get into their question offline. But thank you to all of the speakers for sharing the work you shared today. It was so interesting, and I can just see everyone being nodding along and being on the edge of their seats, as Daniel said. So thanks to everyone for joining as well. And if anyone from SOTR is interested in pursuing EDI research, we do have a new call for grants. And I see that it went into the chat in a weird way, but it is on our Dillon Center website if you're not able to see it through the chat. So thanks to everyone for presenting. Thanks to everyone for attending. And we hope to see you all online soon. Thank you.
Thank you. I always enjoy these BC Solder School discussions because, I guess I'm moving in towards a business kick of things and understanding how, I've had self-employed businesses many times as a filmmaker, usually artistic. The most profitable business that I ever had was when I was a clown and I painted kids' birthday party faces and stuff like that. And, you know, that is that a disclosure that I should be ashamed of? I'm not sure. I know that when I was painting faces on Canada Day at the Parliament buildings, that was the only experience in my entire life that I've been able to make my rent in one day. Of course, my rent was lower because I had roommates, and it was another time. But it was a lot of fun to do those creative endeavors, and it was a lot of fun to make money doing the work that you love. My hope is that I will continue to learn, whether it's with the Satter School or with Royal Roads. I see this kind of study in my future. And I go to all the behavioral insights. Thank you. Bye-bye.